We support the Republican candidate, but we support Lisa also as a Republican and as a friend.
Lisa Murkowski keeps her leadership position on the Energy Committee. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 22nd of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Joe Miller defends taking federal subsidies for his Kansas farm.
It's the way that farming's done. Is it the right way? I don't think it is. I think the free market is the best way, that supply and demand ought to mandate how we go about farming.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Senator Lisa Murkowski prevailed in Washington today, hanging on to her job as the top Republican on the Energy Committee. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, it was a surprising turn of events.
The Republican members of the Senate met behind closed doors Wednesday to discuss Murkowski's future in their conference. Speculation beforehand was that she would lose her ranking slot on the Energy Committee. That job is a plum assignment for Murkowski, who gets to have a strong voice on oil and gas regulation, renewable resources, and a host of other energy issues. Republican leaders have come down hard on her for launching a write-in campaign to keep her Senate seat. Joe Miller won last month's primary, and Washington Republicans have closed ranks around him. While the expectation going into the meeting was that Murkowski would lose the energy assignment as punishment, when the conference emerged, she still had her ranking status. Lamar Alexander of Tennessee is chairman of the Senate Republican Conference.
We've done what we need to do, and we decided not to do more.
Murkowski did step down last week from her post as vice chair of the Senate Republican Conference after pressure from Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and others. Hers was the most junior of the five leadership jobs in the Senate, and she was the only woman. She was replaced in that job Wednesday by Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming. Alexander told reporters that's as far as things went.
Today we elected Senator Barrasso to succeed Senator Murkowski. That was all the action we took today. We discussed a number of other items.
Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas says Murkowski's loss of a role in Republican leadership was punishment enough.
That's exactly what happened, and that's what I think is the right result, and I think that everyone agrees with that, and I think that she on her own chose to step down from leadership, and that was the right thing for her to do, and we all accept that.
Hutchison and Murkowski are two of only four Republican women in the Senate.
Lisa is all of our friend, so I think that we all consider her a friend. I certainly do. We respect her very much, and that's not to say anything about the race that's being run right now. We support the Republican candidate, but we support Lisa also as a Republican and as a friend.
Senator Murkowski asserted on MSNBC Wednesday that she's still a Republican. That hasn't changed, even with her write-in bid. When reporters asked Senator Alexander if she's considered part of the Republican conference at this point, he said, of course. If Murkowski had lost her job as ranking Republican on energy, at least some of her staff would have been out of a job, starting with Energy Republican Staff Director Makai Campbell. For now, he and the rest of the staff stay at work, and Murkowski scores a victory. She can still use her committeeship as a pitch point to Alaskans. Murkowski did not attend the closed-door meeting at the Capitol to plead her case. Instead, she's in Alaska campaigning. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Republican U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller defends his acceptance of federal farm subsidies as just part of modern farming in America. The Alaska Dispatch reported this week that Miller received about $7,000 in federal agriculture subsidy checks during the 1990s for a small farm he owned in his native Kansas. Miller, who's critical of federal aid programs, says under the existing system, farmers don't have a lot of choice.
I, just like the majority of Kansas farmers at the time, received basically payments from the federal government, which were in exchange for compliance with federal programs. It's the way that farming's done. Is it the right way? I don't think it is. I think that actually federal mandates and controls aren't the best way. I think the free market is the best way, that supply and demand ought to mandate how we go about farming. But the way it's done and the way it has been done in farming is that the federal government makes certain mandates. You've got to grow certain crops on certain acres, and you get a payment in exchange for that.
Miller answered questions about the farm subsidies and other issues at a fundraiser in Fairbanks last night. Steve Wachowski, campaign spokesman for Lisa Murkowski, who is challenging Miller as a write-in candidate, he says the farm subsidies are just another example of a politician who says, do as I say, not as I do.
You've got Joe here asking Alaskans to tighten their belts, and this is coming from a guy who not only had his undergraduate and graduate degrees paid by the government, he had the government subsidize his family's health insurance. He's taken government salary almost the entirety of his adult life. And now you're seeing that he took government handouts in the form of farm subsidies.
The campaign for Democratic candidate Scott McAdams had much the same reaction. Campaign spokeswoman Heather Handyside says it makes Miller's whole message less credible.
I think it's just another example of Joe Miller benefiting from the system while he doesn't want Alaskans to benefit from the system through all of his messages with his campaign.
At his Fairbanks fundraiser last night, Miller said he is trying to raise $1 million for his campaign. He says the money is needed to fight the challenge of Democratic Senate candidate Scott McAdams and write-in Lisa Murkowski.
We don't know exactly what she has, but we know it's significant. By some estimates, $1.8 million. And we also know that Scott McAdams has raised, at least by his reports, $300,000. So it's important that we be aggressive in fundraising so that we can counter basically the message that big government's the answer, because we don't believe it is.
Over 100 supporters gathered at his fundraiser last night. The two major party candidates for governor faced each other in Juneau today in a debate before the State Chamber of Commerce. Although there are differences coming to the front between Republican Sean Parnell and Democrat Ethan Berkowitz, and they propose different ways of conducting business, the candidates are focused toward the same goal, improving Alaska's economy. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The gubernatorial candidates are forcing voters to think about issues this year. Economic growth, gas line development, health care, jobs, Alaska's in-state energy, and they're presenting two different approaches to addressing those issues. Governor Parnell said Alaskans cannot just wait for things to happen. They have to make things happen, and he's the candidate that's optimistic about the state's future.
I think you have two candidates up here who cannot and will not be questioned for their integrity, but what we do represent is a different worldview and a different approach to governing.
Democrat Ethan Berkowitz said that to get all the greatness Alaska holds, the people can't be timid. They must be bold and visionary.
What we're signaling here is that we're not going to do things the way we've been doing them before, because a stagnant Alaskan economy doesn't do anything for anybody. We've got to move ahead. We can't just keep treading water. It's not good enough.
The two are already on record on those differences between them. Berkowitz says it's time to admit the current gas line project is not working, saying the state should get ready to take more direct involvement in it. Parnell says it's too early to make that call. Meanwhile, the project is protecting Alaska's interests, and his administration is already at work on a bullet line to deliver gas from the North Slope to other parts of the state. On preparing Alaskans to work on those state projects, Parnell points to training centers, such as a unique core driller program for mining students, and to the merit-based scholarship program for high school graduates, both already in place. Berkowitz says vocational and technical programs are not broad enough, that 40% of high school students don't graduate, and that 30% of North Slope jobs do not go to Alaskans. The Chamber of Commerce debate did not ask for emotional or hot-button decisions, but business decisions from business leaders. Their next debate is scheduled for October 12th in Fairbanks. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a rare grass parka goes on display at the Anchorage Museum.
Because of the way the grass has lets air pass in between, it'll keep you very warm, surprisingly warm.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
University of Alaska students rallied today at the Anchorage campus against proposed college tuition hikes. UA Regents vote tomorrow on a 23% tuition increase. Peter Finn represents the Coalition of Student Leaders. He's traveling to Juneau to take the protest message to the Regents.
You guys being out here makes a huge difference to us. If we can go down to the board and show that students are upset about what's happening here, if we show that students are paying attention, we're going to be able to do a lot more to stop these increases and to keep UA affordable.
Amy Stanley, a political science major at UAA, organized the demonstration in front of the student union this afternoon. Stanley says the general student body only learned yesterday by email about the full amount of the tuition increase.
For one, there's a lack of awareness on the part of the student body. And secondly, it's been really difficult for students to have a voice as the Board of Regents meeting moved from location to location and only meet on the major campuses one or two times per academic year.
The tuition increase proposal would be effective in 2012 and would cost students more than $3,000 in additional tuition by the 2012 and 2013 academic year. The Coalition of Student Leaders and Student Government of UAF, UAA, and UAS have offered a counterproposal, asking the Board of Regents to consider a 7% increase in 2013 in line with past increases and leave 2012 unchanged. The State Board of Regents begin meetings in Juneau tomorrow to vote on the tuition increase proposal. The leadership of three Alaska Native corporations, South Central's Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, or CIRI, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, ASRC, and Interior's Doyon Corporation, collaborated on proposed changes to the Small Business Administration's 8A program. 8A contracting allows small and minority-owned businesses to engage in bidding on government contracts. There are special provisions in place for Alaska Native corporations and other tribal businesses that have helped them garner millions in government contracts around the world. Some of those provisions for ANCs have drawn fire from other minority 8A contractors and members of Congress. Congressional hearings have been held about the provisions. The three ANC presidents sent a letter to SBA Administrator Karen Mills last week, laying out what they're calling an agenda for transparency, accountability, and integrity. Doyon President Norman Phillips Jr. says the three corporate leaders do not see 8A as an entitlement. They realize change is inevitable, and they want to help shape it.
If we continue under the current regime of regulations managed by SBA, we don't see this program being sustainable. And sustainability is important to Doyon because we are looking to the future for other village corporations in our regions, tribes, and the Hawaiian groups as well.
And what about it isn't sustainable? What do you think is at play here that will create that circumstance that it can't sustain into the future?
Well, I think the success of the Alaska Native Regional Corporations in the program is being used or by those that oppose this type of program. And it shouldn't be used against us. You know, we've come into the program, have certainly been successful, but I think the success of the Alaska Native corporations in this program is really being viewed by some as, you know, unfair advantage. But when you look at what we've done, we've created capability. We are, in Doyon's case, we compete on the competitive side. We have very few sole source contracts.
Your proposal is called the Agenda for Transparency, Accountability, and Integrity. What's in the plan to make that happen?
It's really a 9-point program, and it caps a sole source. It provides, I think, some very transparent tracking and reporting requirements of the benefits to the Alaska Native people who we represent. It prevents the you know, the overlapping multiple companies owned by the same entity and just passing those contracts on. It makes them very accountable. Enforcement is very, I think, meaningful in the sense that if any of the participants in the program violate the rules, they should be punished for it.
Does Doyon participate in sole source non-competitive bids, or do you think they should continue to be part of the program and ANCs can decide for themselves?
Well, certainly they should be still be part of the program. I don't think the use of a sole source contract is the problem. I think the impression that, you know, companies are receiving these large contracts is being blown out of proportion, because when you look at the total source, there's a very small group that are larger than $100 million. Yes, Doyon does have some sole source contracts. They're very small, and typically sole source are small. They're, you know, $1 million up to $5 million. But there are needs where you have companies that are, you know, they have that capability to take on a larger contract, savings to the government. Certainly that should be, you know, kept in place up to the $100 million.
Your letter was sent on the 13th. Have you had any response from SBA or members of Congress yet?
No, we haven't.
And what do you think, Mr. Phillips, the state economy and the economy of the ANCs would look like without the 8A program?
I don't know. I know that the Alaska Native corporations bring a lot of money into the state through their participation in the 8A program. What would it be if Doyon or the regional corporations or ANCs were not involved in the 8A program? I think the state would certainly have been impacted by the monies that we bring into the state through corporate taxes as well as benefits to our shareholders.
Norman Phillips, Jr. is the president of Interior's Doyon Corporation. A link to the proposal is on our website, aprn.org. 19 people died in 10 fatal crashes in Alaska from January through the end of August this year. That number is a big jump from the average number of deadly crashes, 6 for the same months in the years from 2005 to 2009. A new study from the Alaska Department of Health tallies those numbers and tries to explain why this year has been so deadly in the aviation industry. Mary O'Connor with the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health in Anchorage wrote the report. She says the accident investigations are still ongoing, but there's one factor that may play a significant role in many of the crashes.
I think most people here in South Central Alaska are aware of the miserable summer that we've been having with clouds and rain, and that may have factored into some of the crashes, and it may have also affected pilots' abilities to go out and fly and remain proficient in their flying skills.
O'Connor said until this year, the number of fatal crashes had been steadily decreasing. She says improved safety equipment is available and commercial air carriers and pilots have gotten better at minimizing their exposure to risk.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. And if you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
A Wrangell man is safe after his fishing vessel sank in Sitka Sound early Tuesday morning. The 44-foot Zamovia sank off of Kulichkov Rock, 6 nautical miles south of Sitka, shortly after midnight. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Coast Guard Petty Officer Charlie Hengen is a spokesman for District 17. She says Air Station Sitka launched a helicopter around 11:40 p.m. A boat crew from Sitka Mountain Rescue was underway at about the same time.
And they arrived on scene almost around midnight, and they were able to embark the man. And once he was aboard that vessel, he was treated for just cold weather exposure and then taken to the Sitka Community Hospital.
The Zamovia is owned by 73-year-old Wrangell resident Wayne Doc Davenport. a retired physician and public radio personality. According to family members, Davenport was in good condition early Tuesday. Don Kluding, the captain of Sitka Mountain Rescue, says the Zimovia was hard aground on Kulichkov, known locally as Six Mile Rock, and in serious trouble.
You know, we had rocks on each side and the surf rolling over it. I figured the only possible point which we could pick him off the boat would be the bow. So we maneuvered in, ended up getting a rope over to him, and felt pretty comfortable, you know, about that scenario because, you know, I tried to get him to tie the rope to himself so that if he went overboard or, you know, something like that, that we'd have a point of attachment to him, be able to pull him back in.
Ultimately, that plan failed. Kluding says the line became fouled on the bow of the Zimovia, and his crew was later forced to cut it. The situation was made more difficult because Davenport, the Zimovia's skipper, was unable to comply with the Coast Guard's request to don his survival suit due to the heavy motion of the boat as it was pounded by the surf. He had also entangled his leg in the Zimovia's anchor gear. With the Coast Guard unable to lower a rescue swimmer to the wreck, Kluding says he took advantage of the rising tide to slip his skiff up to the Zimovia.
The two crew members I had on board the vessel with me, you know, Greg Rashik and Tyler Orbison, were able to stand on the bow of our boat and grab the skipper and help, you know, free his leg, and quite literally had to grab him around the chest and pull him off of his boat.
The Coast Guard Marine Safety Detachment in Ketchikan has plans to examine the wreck of the Zimovia, which sank moments after its skipper was rescued. The vessel has a capacity of 1,400 gallons of diesel fuel. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Although king crab season doesn't kick off until next month, Homer's most famous fishermen are in perilous waters. Captains Jonathan and Andy Hillstrand, operators of the FB Time Bandit, are being sued for $3 million by the same TV network that made them famous. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has the details.
As business at the Homer Harbor continued as usual Tuesday afternoon, the captains of its best-known resident, the FV Time Bandit, are defending themselves against a $3 million lawsuit brought against them by Discovery Talent Services, LLC, a company in the same corporate family as the Discovery Channel. The lawsuit, filed last week in Montgomery County, Maryland, accuses Andy and Jonathan Hillstrand of breach of contract, claiming they failed to follow through with an agreement to film a spin-off show based on their success as stars of Discovery's popular Deadliest Catch. The show, intended to be a one-time special entitled Hillstranded, focusing on the lives of the brothers outside their fishing careers, was partially filmed in June. The lawsuit claims the Hillstrands failed to do follow-up interviews at a later date, causing the show to cancel production. The Hillstrand brothers were traveling out of state Tuesday and cannot be reached in time for this story. In a written response to an interview request from KBBI, their attorney, Jeff Cohen of Beverly Hills, California, accuses parent company Discovery Communications of, quote, astonishing and shameful arrogance and greed. Cohen claims that the sum sought in the lawsuit, $3 million, is greater than the compensation paid to the Hillstrands over five seasons of filming Deadliest Catch. The attorney representing Discovery Communications, Ryan Vangrack of Washington, D.C., did not respond to phone calls in time for this story. Deadliest Catch finished its sixth season this year with its highest ever ratings, finishing as the number one show in its Tuesday time slot. Neither the Hillstrands or Discovery Communications have commented on whether or not the Time Bandit and its crew will be back with the show as it gets set to film its seventh season. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
At the Anchorage Museum at the Rasmussen Center, a woven grass parka has a place of honor in the atrium. It's one of few in the world, in part because weaving a grass parka is time-consuming. It can take 3 to 4 months to make a single parka. The grass is collected when it's tall and green and then dried. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Museum Registrar Ryan Kenny says the parka is one of only three known in existence. One from the early 1900s is at the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. The one in the Anchorage Museum is one of two made by Yupik Lena Ati of Kwingilinok in western Alaska. Although they're rare now, Kenny says grass parkas were once fairly common everyday items.
These were meant to be used. They're working items here, and they're meant to protect the person. And so that combined with, you know, with the grass itself, I think, is not as a long-lasting proper object that could be used. And so they just tended to not be around as long. And plus, the skill and the craft that goes into using and making something like this, there's just less people around that are doing this now.
Woven grass has several useful qualities, says Kenny. When woven loosely, it was flexible and could be folded up into a small bundle. It was used in mats, sails, partitions, and as padding. But Kenny says it was most valued as insulation.
The grass parkas would typically be used underneath possibly a gut parka for a raincoat, or underneath also maybe a fishskin parka. And they're used, the grass has, it's very strong and it has good tensile strength, and so it can be stretched without ripping. But also, because of the way the grass has, lets air pass in between, it'll keep you very warm, surprisingly warm, which is why that grass parkas were used and grass socks were used, grass mittens were used, always as an insulating barrier between the exterior shell and the person.
Lena Oddie says she didn't see anyone using a grass parka when she was growing up, but her father did use grass socks inside his mukluks when he was out hunting. Lena's daughter, Dorothy Oddie, says her 85-year-old mother still weaves, sews, and makes a wide range of traditional items. Translating for her mother, Dorothy said Lena Oddie has seen the grass parka she made at the museum.
Yes, she has seen it before.
And how does she feel about that?
She thinks it's good.
Adi says she also appreciates the attention paid to traditional Yupik life.
She's glad that you ask her about the things that we've made and used long ago.
Along with its permanent collection, the Anchorage Museum is hosting a Smithsonian Arctic Studies exhibit with more than 600 objects showing the science, art, and culture of Indigenous people. Some of the items have never been put on display before. It was put together with the advice of about 40 elders and representatives of various regions of Alaska and Siberia, who chose from some of the 30,000 items at the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian exhibit will be here for several years. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Aaron Selbig in Homer, and Jacqueline Estes and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.